You're listening to Write the Book, a podcast about books and writing for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Mark Estrin and Donna Bister, founders of Fomite Press in Burlington, Vermont. Donna Bister is a photographer, quilter, quilt historian, community activist, voracious reader, and co-author with Richard Cleveland of Plain and Fancy, Vermont's People and Their Quilts as a Reflection of America. She is also, as I became aware during our conversation, program director for WIC, the Vermont Department of Health's Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children. Mark Estrin is a cellist and political activist who writes comic novels about serious things. He's the author of 14 novels, 12 of which have been published and 2 of which are forthcoming. He is a puppeteer and musician with the Bread and Puppet Theater and subscribes to their post-revolutionary ethos. Together, Mark and Donna, who are married, founded Fomite Press with the goal of creating beautiful, if sometimes strange, books. In the 5 years that Fomite has existed, they have published close to 100 books, including those of former Write the Book guests Susan Weiss, Colleen Kieran, Diane Leffer, Richard Hawley, and Gary Lee Miller, who was also my co-host on the show for over a year. The website describes Fomite as a post-capitalist operation in which the authors get almost all profits, and Fomite gets little or nothing beyond expenses. When I spoke with Mark and Donna in August, I began our conversation by asking them to talk about how they came to found Fomite Press.
Mark has for quite some time been part of the group that does readings with each other at the Flynn Dog once a month on Fridays. And before that at Burlington City Arts at the Firehouse.
That was Susan Weiss's.
And I was going to those then, kept hearing lots of great writing from people that we knew either wouldn't be able to be published or didn't have the kind of mindset that would have them go forth and look for a publisher.
Okay.
Which is a time-consuming and
very
disappointing process a lot
of
times. And at some point, I don't exactly remember how or why, we thought, maybe we could do this. And so our friend Ron Jacobs, who had worked with us on a neighborhood newspaper that we did for a while, said, I have a novel. Let's experiment. And so we laid it out, made a cover, sent it off to a print-on-demand service, and it came back and it looked like a regular book.
Did you feel like you cheated?
Not exactly, but, you know,
we didn't know what to expect
yeah. because we use the Amazon service CreateSpace for printing and distribution. It was fairly new at that time. Its reputation was not great, but it seemed to us to be the best of the services that were out there.
Right.
So then we decided, well, we can do this, and we solicited a few people that we knew to submit manuscripts to us. And we're set up, Mark likes to say, not as a business. We're more of a service, and we consider it to be part of our political work. So we do editing, design, layout, all of that stuff. We end up with a good-looking book. And then we...
And five streams of e-books.
Five streams of e-books. Maybe six now, I don't know. We do a little bit of distribution, but we depend on the authors to get their book out there more. So it's a partnership that way. And our financial structure is really different in that we keep for ourselves just enough to break even on the printing software, hardware stuff that we
need.
Mailing. 80% of the net proceeds go back to the authors.
Right.
And in a normal kind of publishing situation, it's more like 10.
Yeah. If you sell the first book, this is very simplistic, but if you sell the first book for $10, do you give $8 to the author, or do you take those $10 and put them toward the production costs before?
Well, that's the great thing about print on demand, publish on demand, is that the startup costs for a book are somewhere around $25. 25
to 50.
That's to
go from a manuscript, a completed, worked on manuscript, designed, page design, to a printed book and five e-books, five different e-books, for $25, $35.
And then once you start doing more books...
Each one costs some money. But, for instance, a novel that might sell for $15, say 300-page novel, comes in at about $4 to buy it.
And production costs.
So,
yeah.
the author, if the author buys them, the author could keep the difference between the $4 that he or she pays and the price on the book. So that's a lot. And if it goes through Amazon or other kinds of internet booksellers, they also take cuts. So mm-hmm. the author gets less. And, you know, we get a check for some total. And then 80% of whatever we get goes to the author.
That's amazing. I mean, the amount of time that you're investing is making this possible. And that's amazing.
That's the business model.
Yeah, yeah.
And why that is...
Yes.
...is... because we remember when the function of publishers, like, you know, when Bennett Cerf was at Random and Knopf was at Knopf and Norton was at Norton, was to nourish, call forth a new American literature.
Mm-hmm.
And now the function is much more like what makes how much money, and that's what we decide to publish, and that's what the agents can afford to handle, et cetera, et cetera. And so we're just trying to go back to the old days when publishing was about literature, not about what MBAs think it's about.
Right.
And the other thing about publish on demand is that there are no books in warehouses. Nothing is printed until it's sold.
Sure.
It never goes out of print. And it can be corrected or updated at any time.
Right.
So 2 years in, somebody's brother-in-law finds a typo on page 87. I can correct it tonight, and it's back on sale. Correct it tomorrow.
Right.
And that's really...
it's kind of crowdsourced the final copy editing.
Who owns the rights to the books?
Authors.
The authors retain their rights.
Yeah, anything. If they get a film offer, they get to keep it all.
Yeah, wow. That's pretty great.
Well, because we're not interested in making money for ourselves or for the press.
You said that it had to do with your political work. Mm-hmm. Those were sort of some of your initial goals. Have your goals changed at all since you've been doing it for 5 years? Or would you say your vision of what's being accomplished has changed at all?
I don't think our vision has changed. I think one of the things we had hopes for in the beginning that has actually come to pass in a pretty significant way is that our authors help each other.
Mm.
And we have a book coming out in the end of October by Lamar Heron, who's a fairly well-known author, has had several successful books with other publishers. He's in Ithaca. We have another book coming out this fall by another writer in Ithaca. They're planning some joint readings and joint promotions.
We have a Chicago group.
We have a Chicago group.
We have a Eastern Pennsylvania group that do things together.
Wonderful.
But I do think something has changed, which is I'm more convinced than ever that there's a terrific need for a model of publishing like this that has these goals. And there's one anecdote that makes that clear, although there are several now... replications of that, but we had a guy who won a Penn Hemingway runner-up, but high award with lots of prizes.
Who was that?
For Peter Wheelwright. Peter Wheelwright. He lives in New York. He's the chair of architecture, space department at the New School. His uncle is Peter Matheson. And that is, he comes from a literary, his brother's a writer, he comes from a literary family, he lives amongst the literati in New York and the professional smart people. And he had a hotshot New York agent. And this agent was not able to get a publisher to publish this terrific book. And I mean, when it came to us, you know, show up on my screen, I don't know how he heard of us in the first place. I read one page of it, and I turned to Don. I said, "This is terrific. This is really going to win some prizes." And in fact, it did. But why couldn't other people publish it?
You know, right. Just,
and we have a couple of things. I'm working on a novel right now that's absolutely terrific. It's also, I'm sure, going to win a lot of prizes. Why has it come to us?
Right.
So the need for this quality of literature to still be accepted somewhere. It comes to us because it isn't accepted.
Mm-hmm.
And that's outrageous.
Are you aware of other publishers that have your same model, people doing this
No.
sort of thing?
Not exactly. There are nonprofit publishers. There are other small presses that do the kind of work we do, but mm-hmm. not in the same model.
Right. Well, I mean, a nonprofit press is still paying its employees, and it's still,
exactly.
you know, it's yes. still got higher costs because it's doing the work for pay mm-hmm. rather than you do a lot of work without pay.
But this isn't crazy, and I think it's very reproducible. That is, here you have two essentially geezers, right? Don is still working. I'm on Social Security, so next year, in 2 years, she gets off her job, she gets retirement, we have Social Security, but we have the values of people who were reading books in the 50s and 60s when books were selected for other values.
Right.
And there must be, you know, 10,000 Mark and Donnas out there who are retired, literate, and passionate about continuing American literature as a strong force in literary history.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see why what we're doing is in any way unique. Unique to Burlington, unique to us. The software is out there. Everybody has computers now. And what you need are people who want to put some time into this kind of a project.
Mm-hmm.
And it wouldn't need to be done on the scale that we've done it on. We've been... This is our fifth year. We have 98 books,
yeah,
I think, now.
Yeah, I mean, amazing.
And maybe another 35 in the queue.
Wow.
Which is a little above our capacity.
Yeah.
Sanity capacity.
Sanity
yeah.
capacity.
Yeah.
But to do six a year?
Right.
But someone could do that.
Anybody could do that who was interested and has the common tools that we have.
Yeah. Now, is it all self-taught, the production side of it? I know that you probably had certain skills that you brought to the table originally, but as far as the software goes and learning how to make books...
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Although I'm a photographer and a quilt maker,
right.
so some of the design parts came more easily to me than
sure.
they might to someone else.
Yeah.
The software, when we started out, we were not using any kind of special software. We used Word and, you know, Adobe.
Yeah.
That's about it. Once I learned how to use more sophisticated layout software, everything became easier.
Sure.
And
it was harder for a week, and then it got easier.
Right. I mean, there are a lot of myths out there about how hard it is to use InDesign, which is the program I use, but I think the basics of it are not that difficult.
Yeah. Okay.
And also, I noticed Donna does, I don't, but she reads a lot of blogs of people who do this stuff and advise each other. There's a community of producers mm-hmm. of books. Now, they all don't all have the same literary values we have, but they have the technology and the technique and
sure.
the understanding about how to use it, and Donna tries to keep up with that.
Yeah, that's great. What are your individual roles in the press?
I'm the acquisitions editor and the editor, which means I sort of intercept the manuscripts that come, and I read the submissions and the submission letters, and I ask for more or I don't ask for more, and then I carefully read the manuscript, and if I like it, we'll say tell the author that I like this, let's work on it, and then we work on it. Some of the manuscripts come in, you know, very, very professionally done and terrific, with very little to do, and some of them need a lot of work, and we go back and forth however many times we need to until I and the author arrive at a manuscript called author's name final. No, it's usually called final one, because final is never final, right?
Yeah.
And so it can go up to final 10, you know. But anyway, when something has the word final on it, it qualifies, it matriculates into, graduates into Donna's queue. So I send it over to her. And then at that point, there may be more as between the author and me still. And she's not going to get to it for a while, but at least it's on queue.
Okay.
And then?
And then, once it reaches the level of queue where I start to work on it, we start with book block design, cover design, all of that stuff to make a beautiful book. And one of the things that's different at Fomite than from other presses is that we involve the authors in every step of that process.
Mm-hmm.
So my startup memo says, okay, it's time to start. Here are the sizes of books that we usually do based on distribution. We get better distribution if we use a standard size.
Right.
Do you have any thoughts on typography, the look of the book? What's your idea for cover? Although Mark often works with people early on cover images.
Okay. The covers are amazing. Your covers are all beautiful. I'm really...
Thank you.
Absolutely. I mean, I really looked at every cover very closely while I was getting ready. I just thought they were so beautiful. And I was very curious to know, like... You know, I happen to know, like, Colleen Kieran's cover.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, what a perfect cover for that book.
Right? And she found it. It's an artist friend of hers.
Yes.
And so most of our cover art, or a lot of our cover art, comes from artists who are willing to let us or the author use their artwork in exchange for some credits and some books.
Yeah.
We don't have money to spend on that. Some of our authors choose to work with an outside designer for professional design.
Mm-hmm.
That's great for us too.
And the reason that we do that differently than most publishers is my experience as an author. And I mean, I have 12 novels out there and the Big Bread and Puppet book.
Yeah.
And I have never been consulted about what the book should look like, and especially concerning about the cover art. And I like some of my covers a lot, and I hate some of my covers.
I like the annotated nose. Did you like that cover?
Yes, I liked it a lot. And the annotated nose is part of the Fomite story, by the way.
Oh, okay.
Which I'll tell you. But you know, usually after the editing is done and you agree that this is the version of the text, it goes into a black hole, and then sometime 6 months to a year later, you get a shipment, you know, an envelope, here's your first book, we hope you like it as well as we do, you know. Well, sometimes it's true, and sometimes it's not true. But we want to avoid that completely, and so the authors are always concerned at every step, consulted in every step of the way, and from manuscript to finished book. And sometimes we get into fights, and especially when an author, say, wants their grandchild to do the cover,
mm-hmm.
or something like that.
Then it's like,
that happened once. But actually, we used that cover.
We did use that cover.
I mean, it was pretty good. But
depends on the grandchild, right?
Yeah, and the book. So that's the why of this approach to authors and design.
Yeah,
and some authors are more interested or have stronger opinions than others. Some have never thought about it. You say, well, go to the library, open some books, send me a picture of what you like.
Right.
And we can start there.
I was struck looking at some of your work online at the use of color in your photos,
mm-hmm.
and I assume in your quilts, although I didn't see any of those, but I was just thinking, I imagine that that's something that you bring to these covers that are so extraordinary. There's wonderful color.
I like saturated color,
yeah.
And I like to use it when I can.
Yeah, that's clear.
The story of Fomite, since you brought up the annotated notes,
and I had a question,
has an interesting story, which is the annotated notes. I don't know if you've read it, but it's about a fictive book called The Nose.
Okay.
That was written in the 60s. That was a huge hit and made the author very rich. And the character in the book hates the book and hates the author. He writes me a letter to ask me if I can get my publisher, Unbridled, to publish a paperback version of The Nose, right, so that he can write annotations for it.
Wonderful.
So on the left side of the, all the left-hand pages are the fictive book called The Nose by William Hundwasser, and on the right-hand pages are all the annotations of Alexei Pigov, the character in the book, contradicting and adding to and whatever Hundwasser's book. So we needed a publisher, a fake publisher, that would have published this fake book. And my daughter is a doctor, and so she suggested using Fomite, and I like that idea because of its Fomite is a surface on which microorganisms are transferred from one
yes.
person to another, like a doorknob or a stethoscope, right? And the idea of books as psychic fomites that are transferring psychic microorganisms from one. So that really worked out nicely, but it came because we needed a fake name for a fake publisher for a fake book, etc.
Years before your press ever was really started.
Right, so when we started the press, we needed a name, and we had a name already there.
When somebody says, what does Fomite mean? I say, well, what do you think it means? Whatever they say is correct. I mean, I've heard an explosive, I've heard a toilet cleanser. It always has some really active...
Oh, that's great. All right, I was going to ask you about your guidelines. And one particular thing that I noticed is that about poetry submissions, you have on your website a special note about poetry submissions. We are most interested in collections that explore a single theme, and we often include serious art, both as cover and internal. Fomite prefers to publish poetry art books appealing to both audiences with combined readings exhibitions. And I love that you do that. I'm curious how you came to that decision, and especially about the single theme. The art makes wonderful sense.
The first poetry book, the first poetry manuscript that was submitted had a single theme. And that's what attracted me. I knew the person, I hadn't seen her in a while, but it was called something like The Empty Notebook.
I was looking at that today.
Yeah. And,
it's like The Empty Notebook talks to itself or something.
The Empty Notebook does this, The Empty Notebook thinks that, The Empty Notebook poses as this,
right,
etc. And it was, I thought, you know, really a terrific take on. And we always knew we wanted to not do, you know, some poems by some people and some people, because poets can get published that way, a poem here, a poem there, and, you know, here's a collection of poems by, you know, X number of poets or whatever. But to feature a poet as a literary artist in one place, because both with that and the short stories, it's easy, way easier anyway, for someone who's not famous but still terrific to publish here and there and here, one little one there, a little one there, a story here, a story there.
Right.
But to get a collection of their poems or stories is hard, and we feel Fomite is filling that hole.
Yeah.
The art issue came up actually sort of stupidly because we like books with spines, and often poetry manuscripts are skinny.
Mm-hmm.
Too skinny for spines.
Right, they're like the staple binding or something.
Well, in our process, we need 100 pages for a spine.
Oh, okay.
That has print on it.
Yeah. Which is good. I have a friend who published a poetry collection and self-published it, and beautiful job, but on the spine there was nothing, and it's sitting on the bookshelf, and there's like, why would anyone pull that off the shelf?
You know? Well, because there's nothing.
Yeah.
To see what it is.
Okay. But I thought it wasn't working.
In 2002 or so, I worked on a big memoir about Bread and Puppet Theater for my 40X years at the time working with Bread and Puppet, and I worked with a photographer. It was his idea. I mean, he came up to me and said, Mark, you know, I have 20,000 negatives of photographs I've been taking over the last 20 years. how about we do a book? So we decided to do the book, but we decided to do the book where the photographs do not illustrate the texts and the texts do not describe the photographs. That is two independent meditations on, and we chose eight themes, eight archetypal themes of Bread and Puppet, and so that's the eight chapters in the book, and then Ron picked photos that illustrated death or fiend or bread or whatever, and I wrote texts, and without looking at each other, so we brought them together. So this idea of independent meditations of mature artists, not illustrations or anything like that, was the core idea of what these poetry books should be. Is to a graphic and a literary meditation on the same subject.
And with your poetry books, and I'm sorry I haven't seen any of them, but are they like that, where it's on one page and it's on another? Is all the art on the left and all the text on the right, or no?
No, not
it
necessarily.
Varies. Okay.
So a couple of our earlier books are bestiaries, and they're also dual language, which is another thing that we like to do. So those
in this case, Italian-English.
Are Italian-English with an image on one page, Italian on the next, English on the next, and then a repeat in a lighter shade of the image on the back.
Mm-hmm.
So that's in a four page
packets.
But others, the images are more randomly dispersed, and they're not necessarily equal in number.
And you know, one of the ideas is that for a launch of a book, it brings the artist's audience together with the poet's audience.
Yes.
And they might not be the same audience. They're probably not the same audience.
Right.
And so it increases the ability of the book / art book to call forth attention.
You're listening to Write the Book, a podcast about writing for writers and curious readers. Today's guests are Mark Estrin and Donna Bister, founders of Fomite Press.
I assume that you don't work with agents when your authors are working with you. Do you ever have authors ask for an agent to be involved?
Yes.
And you say?
No problem.
That's fine.
Fine.
Provided, I mean, the what's not so fun is the agent, you know.
Yeah.
Like, why would an agent want us instead of Random House, you know?
Right. Well, what would the agent's role be with you? Because do your contracts vary from author to author?
Not unless an agent insists on it.
Oh, okay.
So right now we're working with an agent who wanted to add a clause that said the rights of the book, other than explicitly stated in our agreement, which is a page and a half. I mean, it's very simple. Rest with the author in perpetuity throughout the universe.
Really?
I thought, wow, that's over the top. But whatever.
Why not?
Why not? You know.
They use different language. They think differently. So what?
Okay. Wait, yeah. Okay. And, you know, this agent is not going to make a ton of money off this book.
Now, is that your responsibility to then pull the 80% that the author gets into a 15 and a...
We will not.
65 or whatever.
We pay royalties to...
To the author.
One individual that can be designated. In the beginning, we would do a split like that, but I just can't handle it. And I'm doing all of the accounting, the writing the checks,
keeping
track of that.
Well, I can imagine an agent has got a lot of work when it comes to these contracts, because it's all very much in favor of the author.
It's not just that, but we don't really write a contract. We have a letter of agreement in full mighty language.
That says, we do this, you do that. Thank you very much. I think, though, the few agents that we've worked with have been wanted to have that part really clear.
Mm-hmm.
These are the rights that stay with the author. These are the only rights that Fulmite is taking.
Mm-hmm.
And that
is it's already clear, because we only take one thing. We have the right to this particular printing of this book. You know, if he wants to sell it to another publisher and somebody wants to buy it, a big time publisher or whatever, it's fine with us. We have no hold on the book other than the book itself.
Right. And we would be really happy if someone got an offer from someone who could
put $250,000 into publicity.
Into publicity. Yeah. That would be great. It would be great for us, and it would be great for the author.
Okay, so that brings me to a question I was going to ask eventually, which is I know that the authors are responsible to do their own marketing, and I'm wondering how that has, when you've watched your authors, have you seen people make really great strides with their marketing, and what did they do?
One of our fairly early authors did a lot of marketing. He was a young guy. He is still a young guy in the Boston area, and he did a lot with blogs and interviewing himself and putting little quizzes on social media, and he got the book promoted on Boston Public Radio as a great summer read. It's about football.
Good for him.
And we've shared, he's been willing to share with other authors. Most aren't willing to do that level of work.
To share his approach?
His approach, his contacts, whatever.
Oh, I see.
He is in a writer's group in Boston that support each other in doing that, so he had a little bit more backup than other folks. It's all over the place.
Yeah.
It depends a lot on what the success of it depends on the author's initial network.
Mm-hmm. Right.
In other words, if somebody is, say, an English professor somewhere, so right away he has colleagues or she has colleagues or class, people in class, colleagues assign the book, you know, that kind of stuff. So the author starts out with a base.
Yeah.
And that base can grow, geometrically, as each person, if the book is terrific and everybody is excited about it. But you need to start with a base. If you start with zero and you don't want to do anything, it's very unlikely that just the thumbnail on Amazon is going to
do very much.
To do very much.
Yeah. Right?
We would like to do more than we do. And we have interns from various colleges around, and we've been looking for interns who would specifically be interested in social media posting, keeping up our social media presence a little bit, and it's really interesting that it's not their thing.
Mm.
English majors don't do it.
Mm.
And the people who do it are the, what's their major? I don't know, electronic.
Communications, maybe.
Yeah, something. They're already, the first time they touch a key, they're professionals, they want to get paid.
Yeah.
So
that doesn't work for
us. It's different from English majors who would never expect to get paid.
That's true. Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about your work outside of Fomite, each of you. We did talk a little bit about your photography. You've got 12 books you were talking about.
I have 12 novels out, 13 done, one is not out yet. And actually 14 is not out yet.
And are the two that aren't out, do you have, like, are they in progress, or are you looking to figure out what to do with them next?
From my point of view, they're done.
He wants to be a novel ago.
We had decided at the beginning that I should not publish with Fomite, because I had publishers, and Donna didn't want, and I didn't want the press to be seen as a vehicle for my
work. Sure. I think that ship has sailed, though. I think it's clear, although that's not the right expression, I think it's clear that it's not a vehicle for your work.
At this point, but it had to get to a certain point, so maybe when 80 books were out, I proposed to Donna that my next book, which was my last published book, and only Fomite published book, be Fomite, because I wanted to experience what it was like to be a Fomite author.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I like being a Fomite author, and I'm going to publish the next two books with Fomite, just because it's terrific. We treat authors better than anybody.
You're going to get 80%. Donna's going to get 20%.
I can turn it back. But it's just that everything is transparent. You know where the book is. You know how long it's going to take to do that. If you have a different idea, you can change it.
Right.
And it's just everything that an author could could desire. Mm-hmm. And the price you pay is it's a smaller press, but it's a smaller press that's getting more and more kind of known.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
So yeah, the next two books, there's one that's sitting right here and one that's sitting right on over there. So.
Okay. Let's see what's, oh, this one, Hyde.
Yeah, and then yeah.
One of the things Mark did with Hyde and with another book too was we made up some proof copies for him to give to reading groups at the Shelburne Public Library and the Burlington Public Library.
Oh, okay.
As well, he doesn't have an editor.
That's the problem because I don't have me.
So the reading groups sort of operate in that way to give him feedback on what works and what doesn't work.
Interesting. Yeah.
And that, too, I think is a reproducible model because it gives a role to library reading groups. Here you have a bunch of people who are readers and they're interested to have a book that they can not only read, but help
influence.
Shape.
Yeah.
Seems like a terrific idea.
Yeah. That's neat. I'm noticing your Kafka's Roach, The Life and Times of Gregor Samsa. That's a big book.
It's a big book. And I don't know if you want to take the time, but I mean, there's a story about that book, which is that I'll do it quickly. When that manuscript went into my editor, it went in at 900 pages and came out at 600 pages.
Okay. As
Insect Dreams. And that was my first published book.
I remember
book.
That title, right. Okay.
And for the 12 years that Insect Dreams is out, and it was very, very well reviewed. And,
yeah.
I've always felt that it would be really good for people to be able to read the original version, because the original version was not just 300 pages longer,
right.
But it was written in a different format that is of a biography with a very nice narrator, and the tone of the book was much softer because it was this narrator instead of this kind of ferocious plot-driven story of the cockroach. I did ask my editor, who put out six of my books, if he would mind if I did this, since we had the capacity to do it now. And he not only didn't mind, but he was enthusiastic. And in fact, he and I have just finished up a book that he is going to publish with his company, which is a dialogue between him and me concerning editing and
the whole
going from Kafka's Roach to Insect Dreams to Kafka's Roach public.
Wow.
You know, the director's cut. What is the function of a director's cut in these days where people can self-publish?
Okay.
And does everything get a director's cut? What is the role of an editor? So he will bring that out. Donna won't let me jump the queue, so this can't come out for a year. Because this is coming out next month.
Okay.
So he is going to bring out our dialogue, which he calls the Insect Dialogues, about Insect Dreams, 2 months before.
Before this. Before well, that's that. Probably good.
Well, we'll see.
So is this Hyde as in Jekyll End?
You sure?
Cool. And this one's much different looking in size and scope. Your is this cover by the same artist who did the bird on your website?
No.
Okay.
Who is this?
It's a student from Britain.
Oh,
we get some of our artwork from a website called DeviantArt.
Okay.
Where artists just share things.
Sure.
And they sometimes sell prints, and we've had really good luck contacting people from that site and asking
permission.
Permission to use their work.
But that artist who did the annotated nose cover is going to do the cover for the Insect Dialogues that Fred and I just did.
Oh, interesting. Okay, great, yeah.
She was his cover artist for that book.
Okay. All right, great. And then let's talk a little bit about your work. What kind of photography do you do? Do you commission for certain kinds of events?
I don't do photography as a job.
As not your job.
My job is managing the WIC program for the state of Vermont, a nutrition program for pregnant women and little kids.
Oh,
so
wonderful.
Photography is something I do as fun.
Okay. Who has time for that on top of all of this?
Well, I like to travel. I travel a fair amount for my job.
Okay.
And I usually try to add on a day or two so I can take pictures in some exotic location, like mm-hmm. eastern Kansas or...
Okay.
Where am I going now? Denver, so...
Oh, great.
Small towns around Denver, that'll be great for me. It's
anything
perfect.
Broken down.
Anything with intense color and not too shiny, I tend to like. And I used to be a quilt maker, and then I started working with antique quilts and doing documentation, historical mm-hmm. documentation. So,
what she does is really interesting. She is one of the key people in something called the Vermont Quilt Search. And Quilt Search goes around to small towns and puts up a notice and says, if you bring your quilts to the Grange on this and this day, we will take a picture of them. You can tell us the stories of the quilts and all of that. And so they have documented, 6,500
quilts. Oh, wonderful.
Quilts and have photographs.
Mostly in Vermont.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it's a great project.
Your homepage says that Fomite is a literary press whose authors and artists explore the human condition, political, cultural, personal, and historical, in poetry and prose. And I wondered if you feel that you get a higher level of submission because of this standard. I also wondered if you get a lot of submissions that are trying to meet the standard, but do not. And then finally, I was going to ask, what happens if you get an excellent book whose philosophy you do not share?
Yeah. Those are all interesting questions. And I'm involved with one right now. We have published one that I thought maybe was politically incorrect to publish. I don't know if you saw the sign on the front of our house that says Smash Capitalism.
I saw it, and then I came around and it's parked in back, so...
It also says, Erotix malorum cupiditas est, as an explanation of why you need to smash capitalism. The root of evil is greed.
Okay.
Right. So, you know, we're both very, very politically radical left.
I saw the Jill Stein stickers.
Yeah, we have two out of the only 10 Jill Stein stickers on the car. In Vermont, I mean... And that's true because there were only 10 on the table in her one appearance. Politically, I'm working on a book now. It's 1,500 pages. It's a beautiful, terrific prize winning. It's the book I mentioned before, prize winning novel about a guy who was a. It's three generations, but the center generation is a guy who was a CIA agent. Well, no, the son is the CIA agent, and the father was also CIA. You know, it's very, very sympathetic X-ray of the mind of people that are on a different political side than I am.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was reading through it, I was thinking, oh, God, I realized that, first of all, the writing is so good, and, you know, he gets a chance to describe this person. We need to know what these people think and what their values are, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm definitely going to do the book, although I have to say that politically, it's not where we are.
Well, another story, too, is Martin Ott. I can't remember what branch of the service he was in, but he was a
military intelligence
yeah. interrogator.
Interrogator.
And he sent this group of stories called Interrogations, which are not specifically about that. But we thought, again.
But one of the stories is, and they are very much informed with the kind of knowledge and strategy of interrogators, which is hairy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Hairy.
I mean, there's the argument to be made that no matter which side it's portraying, if there is honesty in it,
no, absolutely.
It brings about discussion and conversation.
Yeah. And literary merit.
And literary merit.
Yeah.
Okay.
No doubt.
How many submissions do you get, and how much do you take? Have you ever...
We're in hiding. and it's not helping. I mean, it is helping. We've had our red light guy up for a year. We thought, you know, we'll put him up for 6 weeks and catch up and da-da-da. And there's no way we can catch up, even with the red light guy on. So I'm not sure. I mean, it's sort of dishonest because we are accepting some stuff, but there are specific people that have passes around the red light, which is authors with second, third, and fourth manuscripts and you know, friends, yeah, good friends, good writer friends recommended by their authors, and their authors have recommended us to their good writer friends, and da-da-da-da-da.
All that means is you take a look, though. It doesn't mean...
Yeah, but yeah. You know what?
But they tend
you
to
like
be good.
A lot of them.
They're good.
Yeah.
And they know what we're about,
yeah.
Because they know the authors that we... Know. So it's horrible how good this stuff is.
I think the other thing that happens is that people who don't know us personally or have some connection see the red light and don't submit, unless they're doing a more of a kind of spray it out there and see if anybody bites kind of thing, which we don't necessarily look at anyway. Mm-hmm. We do get some inquiries from people who have things that we wouldn't even consider, like memoirs or children's books, and we've done some work with some folks who have stuff like that mm-hmm. to help them learn how to do it themselves.
One of the things that Fulmite, that we conceive as our role, is aiding the success of the whole self-publishing revolution for self-publishers.
Sure.
Because we think that that's a really, really strong and finally unbeatable challenge to industrial publishing.
Yeah.
And so if somebody has a book that we don't want, we'll say, you know, why don't you come over, we'll sit down and give you a 101 on self-publishing it. And we do that. We've done
yeah,
it quite
we've done
a bit.
That quite a bit.
That's nice.
That's part of our role.
Particularly for books that probably are not things that would be publishable otherwise. For example, early on we had someone who had a series of children's books dealing with the environment that mm-hmm. she had an agreement with some branch of the UN to publish and distribute for free. That's not something we're going to do,
mm-hmm.
but we could teach her how to get it done fairly inexpensively so that the UN could produce however many thousands of copies and distribute them and to do it and do the books in multiple languages and for multiple countries.
Right. Okay. So I feel like hearing what you've said and having looked at all of the information on your website, I feel like this may be the future of publishing for what was once known as the mid-list author who's been really
exactly.
cut out
yeah.
of the larger publishing game. So short of more people doing this sort of thing, you would encourage people to self-publish in that case if they're not finding publishers.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Because they have the same tools we have. They can make as beautiful books as we make.
But they should hire editors.
Unless they are terrific at doing that themselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, somehow, between us, we can turn out a highly edited book.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'm not an editor, I'm a writer.
Mm-hmm.
Donna runs the RIT program. You know?
I'm a reader.
She's a reader.
Well, that's a qualification in itself.
Yeah.
And I think self-publishing doesn't have the same...
vanity press.
Stigma
that it used to have.
Mm-hmm.
There are enough fairly successful and famous people who are doing it now.
Mm-hmm. I had a disappointing moment in an interview where I was talking to an agent, and I asked, will you look at works by authors who have previously self-published? And she said, no, our agency won't look at works by authors who have I said, what about authors who have had a book published by a small press? And she said, pretty much no, because the editors that I'm talking to want everybody to be a blank slate. So unless you're a published author who's sold really well, we don't really want to look at you at all, unless you're brand new. And that was kind of disappointing to me. I just thought, wow, that's so limiting to everybody.
No, absolutely. It's the celebrity publishing thing. And part of who are the celebrities are certain houses. I mean, everybody, every reviewer will say, what's Knopfrot coming out, you know?
For her.
Right. But nobody's going to say, before we make a figure out, let's check what fomite's coming out. Although they should.
They definitely should, although I can understand how some reviewers must be completely overwhelmed.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And agents,
yeah.
too.
Yeah.
You know, what do you accept? If you're going to make any money at all doing it, and also the public, you know, a lot of publishers now, to maximize profits are firing editors. Mm-hmm. Books are unedited. They're requiring the agents to do the editing
mm-hmm.
before anything is submitted. So not only do they only accept agented copy, manuscripts, but they only accept agented, edited manuscripts.
It's ready to go. Just put it in the machine and press play.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So you know, what's an agent supposed to do?
Yeah.
Except turn down 99% of what anybody wants to submit.
Sure. Yeah. What would your advice be? A lot of my listeners are writers. Also, the tagline on the show is writers and curious readers. So a lot of them are writers. So my question is, what advice do you have for what sorts of questions authors should ask of small publishers like Fomite before deciding to publish with them?
I don't think you go to a publisher to ask questions.
If you say, I think we want to publish your book, are there things that people should understand about what's moving forward
yes.
that they should be aware of ahead of time? Like, do people come to you with false expectations, do you feel?
Yes. I mean, so some people have sat in the chair you're sitting and told us how they want to make $100,000 on this book.
Mm.
it's comical, but...
That's
know.
Nice.
You know, we tell them they're not going to make much money. People don't spend a lot of money on literary fiction. They don't. Not a lot of people read literary fiction and poetry, etc. So, but that's rare. Usually, when I accept a book before anything else, I send the author a copy of what we call our author info sheet, which, as Donna was saying, says what we do, what we don't do, what we would expect them to do, etc., etc. And I think they just have to look at the books we've published, sort of intuit the levels that we're looking for, and then, you know, by the time they're asking those questions, they've already done that. And
yeah.
And they don't all say yes. We've had several people go elsewhere
okay.
to other small publishers.
Uh-huh.
I don't know why. No, really, because
no.
they don't get as good deal as they get with us. But
is it a perception of increased publicity?
The last person who went somewhere else, we actually said, would you mind telling us why? Because he came to visit us even. He and his wife came to visit us, and we had a fairly long conversation about his book and about the publishing industry and so on. And I think he just...
And I had already done a lot of work on the book.
He felt like this other small publisher in Louisiana was just a better fit for him. Some of that had to do with he thought our website was not spiffy enough, a few other things
really?
Like that. And his wife was actually quite active in publicizing his previous book, and I think there might have been something there, like she felt like she could do more with
the other press. Okay.
Huh. It's mysterious.
It is mysterious.
And nobody has the answer.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, mid-range, but the few big publishers have the answer. It's called big bucks. So you buy front out at the books, to face out on the bookstore shelves or front table at the book. You buy a quarter page ad in the New York Review or whatever. That's called the answer. And it's called big bucks. But
yeah.
Nobody who doesn't have that can do anything more than we do.
Right. Yeah. Why don't you just end by telling me maybe two books that are coming out that you're excited about. What's coming out next that's...
Gales. So we have a category called Odd Birds Eluding the Net of Classification. And we have a book coming out called The Fall of Athens, which combines about every odd bird thing that we have. So it's... dual language, Greek and English.
Wow.
Not entirely, but Gail Holst-Warhaf, whose book it is, who's the author, is a wonderful poet in her own right, but she's also translated several Greek poets. So there are those two things.
She was a pianist for Theodorakis. So she was involved in the whole 70s general thing in Greece.
Okay.
And she also made a movie about the kind of underground blues music, traditional Greek blues music.
Oh, wow.
That was starting to die out in the 70s, and she was probably, then in her 20s. And she did this whole big documentary film about all of these older men who played in the hookah bars in Greek cities.
And does the book have to do with that too, or
there's some about that. There's some about all of that.
Okay,
so that's why it's so odd.
Yeah,
it's this combination of her telling of the story of that time and her place in it, her relationship with, in particular, one of the traditional musicians, just her musical relationship with him over many years, the translations of Greek poetry, productions of Greek plays outdoors.
Oh, wow.
It's just as odd as it can get, and it's beautifully written.
Odd meaning it doesn't fit in a category.
I mean, the odder, the harder to place,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
If it's not fitting in this genre, or, you know, if it's not at least, yeah.
The other thing that we're doing as policy is we're trying to work with Bread and Puppet. Both of us have been longtime puppeteers. And to bring out in book form whatever of Bread and Puppet can be put between two, covers of a book, which is not a whole lot because Bread and Puppet doesn't exist in books. Bread and Puppet exists in fields and, on the world stage and, in the demonstrations and blah, 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 blah. But Peter is, Schumann, the director, is now 82, and he's beginning to think about something called What Happens After Peter. And so we are working with Bread and Puppet, and we've done 4 Bread and Puppet books.
Mm-hmm.
This past year, we did a book which contains a lot of texts of the shows that are being made this year.
Okay.
Called Faust 3. And then the year before, we did a book which was trying to rescue some of the crazy mishmash that is in many, many years of his school notebooks that he just scribbles in, and get some of that out so it's readable and thinkable. And that was called Bread and Sentences. And so I'm enjoying very much, and he just called the other night and said, let's do a book this coming winter called The Gardens of Earthly Delight, because this is the 400th anniversary of Bach's death.
Okay.
And so he's going to do Bach up, because the last book, it was called Faust 3, Goethe finished Faust 2 at the same age as Peter is now, so Goethe gave permission to Peter to do Faust 3. So we're having a lot of fun with those books.
Yeah, do those jump the queue? Those jump the queue.
Those are queue jumpers.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's our lifelong kind of debt to Bread and Puppet.
Yeah.
As audience, as puppeteers. In fact, the whole Bread and Puppet philosophy is formative for Fomite. Because Fomite is based on the same kind of volunteerism and cheap art, not et cetera, et cetera, that Bread and Puppet values. All the art in the house is Bread and Puppet. We try to live out this post-revolutionary example.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Sure,
thank you. A pleasure.
This week's Write the Book prompt was generously suggested by my guest Donna Bister. Write about your first pair of shoes. Or, if you can't remember your first pair of shoes, write about your favorite pair of shoes. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know. Archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.com. writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Write the Book is going to be joining WBTV, the new low-power station in Burlington, Vermont, very soon. I'll keep you posted about that on my Facebook page and in coming episodes of the podcast. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book, coming to you from Burlington, Vermont.